Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Smita Singh, the director of the Global Development Program at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. Today's program is generously underwritten by the Corrett Foundation. It is my pleasure to introduce Dambisa Moyo, the author of Dead Aid, Why Aid Is Not Working and How There Is a Better Way for Africa. Ms. Moyo is an economist with a degree in chemistry from the University of Zambia, an MBA from American University, and a master's degree from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and a PhD in economics from Oxford University. She's worked as a consultant with the World Bank, and until recently was the head of economic research for Africa with Goldman Sachs. Ms. Moyo currently lives in London, though I suspect these days she's spending more time on the road, talking about the ideas that she puts forward in her new book, Dead Aid, which is what she's here to do with us today. Dead Aid has generated a firestorm of commentary from supporters and detractors. Kofi Annan says that she makes a compelling case for a new approach in Africa, and the historian Niall Ferguson has quipped that we need more Moyo and less Bono. At the same time, she's also been called recklessly contrarian. But what both those who agree with the ideas that she's put forth and those who disagree can actually agree on is that with her book, Ms. Moyo has jump-started a valuable conversation that we need to be having about aid, when it works, when it doesn't work, and what we should do about it. With that, please welcome Ms. Dambisa Moyo.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to everyone here. I must say, I've been here a couple of days now, today is probably the warmest day since I arrived, and so I'm really surprised to see so many people indoors. If it wasn't for the fact that I had to speak myself, I probably would have sent my body double and would be outside enjoying the San Francisco and the weather here. Nevertheless, thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I very much view the fact that you're here as an indication that, like me, you are incredibly concerned about the plight and the state of the African continent today. And so I'm very happy to share with you some of my thoughts, many of them coming out of my book, Dead Aid, as Smita mentioned. What I thought I would do today is kind of break down my discussion into three parts. The first part really to give you some disclaimers. If you had met me about 2 months ago, I probably would have just launched into my attack on why I believe aid is not working. However, I've learned an incredible amount having spent time with average people across the African continent and in donor countries such as the United States and Western many places in Western Europe, but also with the leadership. So some of the most senior cabinet ministers and civil servants in places like Norway and Sweden and Denmark, but also with the heads of states across the African continent. So that's kind of helped me form a bit more information, and I'd like to share some of those thoughts and the thinking around those experiences. So if you indulge me, the first part will be a little bit about the disclaimers and what I've learned in that time. And then I'll talk to you a little bit about why it is I see that aid has actually contributed to much of the failure that we see in terms of in the economy across the African continent. And I've kind of tried to make it a bit more interesting. So I call it the top 10 reasons why aid doesn't work. However, given time constraints, I might not be able to go through all of them. And I hope that that will be a motivation for you to go out and buy the book, if I can at least be interesting here. And then finally, I want to end off with some positive stories. And very often I find that when we talk about Africa, the story is always quite morbid and sad and negative. And I just want to leave you with a bit of a taste of some of the positive things that are going on the continent and hope that we can use that regardless of our inclinations, whether we're pro-aid or against aid or and so on. But I hope we can leave here today with that positive element in mind and recognize that from there we can actually continue with the debate and really try to move the continent forward. Okay, so let me first of all start by saying that we are all on the same side. I believe we all want the same thing. And really this thinking has become much more clarified to me, became much more clarified to me on a trip I made to Norway about 2.5 months ago now. I was invited by the Minister of International Affairs and Development, Erik Sonheim, and I was quite surprised, actually, because some of you might be aware that Norway gives about over 1% of the country's income to aid. And so I couldn't really understand why it was that the minister was inviting me there. Nevertheless, I'd never been to Oslo, and I thought, why not, if the government's going to pay for it? And it was even more of an incentive. I went to Norway and had very much like today, had a public meeting where I sat down with the Minister of International Affairs, and we were both given a few minutes to kind of offer our broad opinions with respect to aid, not only just to Africa, but aid broadly as a tool for generating economic development and meaningfully reducing poverty. Anyway, at the end of the discussion, which was completely civil and was very amicable, a journalist walked up to me, quite a lovely but at the same time kind of irritated, and said, you know what, to be honest, I'm very disappointed with this whole session. And I said, why? And she said, because actually you agree. And it wasn't as interesting as she had hoped. She thought there was going to be a mud wrestling or something. In any case, I went away and I thought about it, and really I realized that there are at least three things that we as a society agree on, and I want to share them very quickly with you. The first one being that I think we all agree that Africa should not be dependent on aid forever. I think we all want a society to exist and emerge from the African continent where we don't have to be talking about a situation where a whole continent basically is so dependent on aid, where over 70% of government's expenditure in some countries is aid dependent. So I think that's pretty not controversial, we all agree. Of course, we'll talk a little bit about when that might happen. Is it going to be in the next 10 years, or is it going to be another century or another millennium? But I think broadly we agree that it would be nice if Africa were not dependent on aid. The second thing I believe we agreed on is the fact that we need African governments front and center on the agenda to reduce poverty and increase growth in the African continent. And again, not very controversial. The idea, I believe, that governments have to be at the center of the economy, but also particularly leading the charge in development, I believe is actually very well-founded. And some people, particularly in places in the United States or in much of Europe where the political dichotomy is kind of either left or right, where the government's either really involved or not really involved, might find that peculiar, given some of the prescriptions I'll talk about later in development. But just for now, understand that my main point here is that we do need African governments to take the lead. It's not good enough to have an army of NGOs or Western donors opining on what they think needs to be done in Africa. Nothing is going to happen until African governments are the ones leading the charge, coming up with the plan, articulating the strategy for Africa's future. We need that. So that's the second point. The third point is that and this is a point that Minister Sonheim made, which I was stunned he made it so publicly, but the third point is that aid has contributed to the dysfunctionality of the African state. We have to agree with that. Of course, it's in different degrees. I myself would argue that for many African countries, it has contributed to corruption. So it's actually providing a rent, which governments have stolen in the past. But even in the best case scenario, and even in my own country, one of the artifacts of the aid model has been that African governments can abdicate their responsibility. So somebody else is going to do it. And I'll come back to this point because I think it really lies at the heart of why aid is actually not doing what it was supposed to do. So let's, I think, agree that these broadly are three things that we can agree on, that, as I said, we don't want Africa to be on aid forever. We want a vibrant society where Africa can be an equal partner in the global stage. Second of all, we need the African governments. We've got to incentivize them for them to be excited about getting their people out of poverty. And third, aid, unfortunately, and it's an inadvertent, unintended consequence, but it has contributed to dysfunctionality. Let me take a moment to just explain what we mean by aid here, because I think this is also something that has been misinterpreted, and in fact I've been misrepresented in some media articles as being a genocidal maniac who wants to kill African babies. And I think, just let me take a moment here. On page 7 of my book, I basically argue that there are broadly three types of aid. The first type of aid being humanitarian aid. So think about a Katrina or Fargo. A few months ago when I was here, there was some problems there. Or a tsunami or an earthquake or a flood. These are the type of calamities where it seems to me, as a global community, we should act. There's a moral imperative for us as human beings to act when our fellow human beings are suffering somewhere on Earth. And so in that sense, my book is not about that type of aid, those type of humanitarian disasters. The second type of aid is what I would consider as more NGO or charitable aid. So think about somebody sending $10 to a girls' education program in Africa, or sending some money to support a well in Latin America or something like this. Relatively small amounts of money going to support certain targeted projects around the world. With respect to this type of aid, I would say it's important to understand what this type of aid can and cannot do. So yes, perhaps we can actually get a girl to go to school. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's a good thing. But it's never going to be enough or strategic enough to actually meaningfully put a dent in poverty or enable these countries to grow at the levels of growth that we need to see them grow to transform their societies and the living conditions of their many citizens. So in that sense, I very much view NGO interventions as band-aid solutions. They're dealing with the superficial problem, but not with the real inherent structural problem that we have going on in the African continent. So again, my book is not about this, but as I said, if you have a copy of my book, on page 7, I do talk about these differences. The third type of aid is the one that my book is really targeted, and this is the large billion-dollar packages that go to African governments every single year from donors, Western country donors primarily, such as the United States, but also from international organizations such as the World Bank and other aid agencies. I'm going to talk to you a little bit in a moment about why it is that I think that these types of the third type of aid has been particularly detrimental and problematic in the African context. I want to just remind you at this point why it is this whole aid model emerged in the first place. It's from the 50s and 60s, really, when this idea really gained a lot of traction. It was after the Marshall Plan, where there had obviously been success with the aid interventions of the Marshall Plan. But remember also that this was the time when many African countries were coming out of a colonial period and were actually about to embark on their own independent countries and as independent countries. The simple model of economics was that basically savings would lead to investment and investment would lead to growth. And that was kind of a standard identity in the economics literature. And the point just became that where we did not have savings, instead of savings, we'd put in aid, and so aid would lead to investment and lead to growth. So it was a very reasonable model, couched in logic. There didn't seem to be anything wrong with that. However, obviously, with over 60 years of experience and the over $1 trillion of cash that has gone to Africa, we have seen growth decline on a trend basis across the continent, and we've also seen poverty levels increase. So, for example, in the 1970s, 10% of the African population lived in dire poverty. Today, over 70% of Africans live on less than $2 a day. So extreme poverty. But we'll come back to that issue in a moment. The last thing I want to say something very quickly about, and I've been debating whether or not to say this, but since it's such a lovely day, I will comment a little bit about the celebrity culture. I really hesitate to do this because I do think that the whole celebrity issue is a red herring to really fundamental issues that we should be thinking about. But a couple of the points that I'm going to mention with respect to the celebrity culture, I mention simply because they are contributing to the problems of the aid culture. the two points are simply that I strongly believe that they do have a following, clearly, and they have a platform where people do sit up and listen to what celebrities say. However, they use that platform in a very negative way, which unfortunately discourages people, investors, from going to the African continent, which can actually create jobs on the ground. So my view is, why not use the platform that you have to actually push out a positive message? And there are lots of positive things we can talk about. We're going to talk about them later. But more importantly, I very much view the celebrity culture as an artifact of the aid regime. The fact that African governments across the continent, not all of them, but many of them, really cannot be bothered to articulate for us as global citizens, or even citizens of the African continent, what their plan is to reduce poverty and increase growth, I believe is particularly problematic. What has essentially happened is that a vacuum has opened, and we now have celebrities going to G8 and G20 meetings on behalf of the African population, but they are not elected representatives, nor do they have a good understanding of the workings of the continent. I've said very flippantly in the past that it's tantamount to the Americans hearing nothing from the Obama administration about the housing crisis and the financial crisis here in the United States, or the auto workers, and instead constantly hearing from Michael Jackson about what he thinks is going on. I say that flippantly, but again, it really does go to the core. And I'll come back to this point because a number of African friends of mine have said, well, actually, you know, well, why do we even bother going to vote? Why are we voting for and electing officials to hold office when they actually don't have a strategy, or somebody else who doesn't live in Africa is offering a strategy? Okay, so those are kind of broadly my disclaimers, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through this afternoon. But let me just quickly go through my top 10 reasons why I believe aid is not working. And reminding you again, I'm not talking about NGO aid or emergency aid. I'm really focused on these large government-to-government flows. I'm going to start off with the most obvious one, because it's obvious and I think we need to get it out of the way. And I think a lot of people think that there's only one problem with the aid system, and that is really the fact that it fuels corruption. Unfortunately, the whole notion and the grotesque use and theft of aid money is not something of the past. Of course, there have been the disgusting stories of Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, or President Bokassa of Central African Republic, but unfortunately, a lot of that continues today. In my own country, the former president of Zambia, who was in charge from 1991 for 10 years, is currently embroiled in a scandal of stealing aid money. Right next door, the president, former president of Malawi, is also has been charged with stealing aid money. And this morning, on my way here, actually, my best friend who lives in Zambia in southern Africa telephoned me and said, "Have you seen the news?" And I said, "No." She goes, "Haven't you seen what Sarkozy has done?" Some of you might be aware of this, President Sarkozy of France. I had not seen it, but basically, he has just frozen the assets of three African presidents, sitting presidents, way into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And he's decided to take this unilateral action because he said there is no way that these countries, I believe Niger and I'll say Niger for sure, but I can't remember the other two, given the levels, the depths of poverty, there is no way that these governments could have earned that money in order to own these chateaus and assets in France and holding money in French bank accounts. Anyway, all of this is to say that unfortunately, the fact that aid, which is transfers of money going into these governments, pooling at the government level, is still flowing into African governments. It's essentially free money. The governments can take it, and by and large, with no penalties, we continue to see this pattern of theft. But that's just one thing. That's just corruption. Even if we could curb the corruption, which we've tried to, by the way, through conditionalities in the 80s, for example, there's still a whole host of other issues that emerge from a policy, an active policy of aid, which I want to go through very quickly. Some of the things, for example, include the fact that it encourages large bureaucracy in government and dependency, relatedly dependency. And that the problem with the dependency syndrome, it doesn't motivate African governments to go and find alternative ways of financing development. there's so much ossification, and I'm sure anyone who's lived in Africa or is from Africa will know that it's an absolute nightmare to even get basic services, to get the economies going. Starting a business, which I'll come to later, is an absolute nightmare. But also in terms of the bureaucracies, it's still the case that in many countries, as I said earlier, over 70-80% of the government expenditure is actually aid money. So the governments have not made the significant strides that they need to make to actually diversify their pot of money. I was in Zambia 10 days ago, went home, and had a meeting similar to this with a number of Zambians in the room, so the academics and business people. And there was a loud gasp in the room when an American from the USAID program, a funded program, stood up to say that in a country, our country, Zambia, where one in three Zambians is HIV positive in the city, so it's one of the worst AIDS statistics, the American government was still spending, in terms of resources and providing infrastructure, was still over 92% of the provider of HIV drugs and services into this country. And the Zambians in the room were essentially outraged, because if a crisis where one in three of your population is afflicted is not good enough to get your government up and outraged, and we need to sit back and wait for the Americans to come in and save us, this is not a sustainable situation. And I'll come back to this because, again, let's remember that the United States itself has its own challenges. What is happening in Detroit, the fact that you're facing 10% unemployment rates, the fact that Germany, where I was about 3 weeks ago, I went to a trade union conference there, which was very interesting. People are desperately concerned about their own futures. Germany is facing a 6% contraction this year. These are countries, even if they want to give aid, it's not likely that they'll be able to. The United States is borrowing from China. It's not like America has a pot of money. So it's not reasonable for us as Africans to sit back and expect somebody to provide us with this health care. But anyway, so bureaucracy and dependency, whole host of examples in this context, and we will talk a little bit more about that later as well. Then very quickly, things like inflation, the fact that Africa remains with a large debt burden, the fact that there's something called Dutch disease, which is basically the idea that all these dollars going into a small country is actually causing the domestic currency to be very strong, and that kills off the export sector and has very negative effects on the economy. These are all economic aspects, but I want to remind you that it's not me who's just making them up. A lot of this is actually already documented in the economics literature, which, by the way, has been written by development agencies themselves. So remember, here we have an active development policy where we're actually trying to do good, and yet we're creating inflation, we're killing off the export sector in these small economies. I'm thinking about point six now, which is about the fact that governments abdicate their responsibilities, a very serious problem in Africa, and I've alluded to this already. The fact that African governments are sitting back and not providing the goods and services that they are charged to do. Let me remind you that when Americans go to the polls to elect their presidents, so you go into your booth and you're trying to choose between McCain and Obama, for example, the choice is really about who you believe is actually going to provide Americans with the best set of public goods, which is basically education, healthcare, infrastructure, and even security. So you sit there and you decide, well, I think the Democrats will be better at providing this set of public goods to Americans. That's not the case in Africa. It's now at a situation where in many, if not most, African countries, that set of public goods, which you choose your leaders based on, is now provided almost wholesale, but certainly largely, to a large extent, by foreigners. I've already alluded to the fact that it's unsustainable because it creates a vulnerability for us. If the American government tomorrow has to pull back on AIDS funding, not because they don't feel sorry for Africans, but because they simply cannot raise the tax base and they have other pressing concerns for Americans themselves, what will then happen to the Africans on the ground? It is not a sustainable solution. We're looking for sustainable solutions here. It's not just about the fact that our governments are not providing these public goods. The more fundamental problem is that we don't even have a discussion of a strategy of a day when they will be providing these public goods. It is not reasonable, and it is not sustainable, And it's not something that as Africans we should sit back and say it's okay because Germany's going to give money to us or America's going to give money to us. And then this is why I think the credit crisis is actually a wonderful opportunity for us to have this discussion about what are we going to do next and how are we going to do it. And what I would say is don't feel sorry for Africa. You know, the IMF forecasts for GDP growth this year are still at around 3% for the African continent. That's much better than, as I said, the contraction that Germany might be facing or the fact that global growth could be about 0.5%. So there is a positive story coming out here. We need to foster that and figure out a way so that the next time we have a crisis, either a global recession, Africa has got some way of continuing to give the programs and the public goods that it needs to provide to its people. All of this is basically touching on the fact that the problem with the aid model is that African governments view aid flows as permanent income. They don't think there's ever going to be a time when it's going to end. And I think it's critically important to understand this because the times that aid programs have worked, such as the Marshall Plan or the Green Revolution in India or the interventions in places like South Korea or Botswana even, in the book I call them the aid graduates. In fact, they're known as the aid graduates, about 22 countries that have graduated from relying on aid. In all of these instances, there's one key difference between the aid that we gave in those scenarios and the aid that we give to Africa. In the former case, the aid was short, sharp, and finite. So Marshall Plan, five-year program, in what today would be about $100 billion. Whereas in the latter case, the aid programs that are going to Africa today are open-ended commitments. There is not even a discussion of a time when Africa can start to think about emerging on its two feet and figuring out how to provide goods and services to its own people. Linked to this is this whole notion that African governments are not incentivized to do that. Why would they actually get up and go and find alternative ways of financing, which can be hard work, when actually they can sit there and continue to receive inflows? I'll come back to this point. In fact, I was in Stanford this morning, and the interview at the Hoover Institution said, basically, the African governments in Africa is kind of like a teenager that we all know, whether it's our sibling or a cousin, somebody who kind of lies on the couch and every month you're pulling your hair out saying, please go and get a job, and the person doesn't do that, but they know that you're going to still provide a roof over their head. And basically, you want them to do well and do better, but it's latent potential and they're not doing that. But I'll talk a bit more about this. I'm on point eight here, I believe. The fact that I believe aid kills off entrepreneurship. Again, this is an unintended consequence. We're in a situation where in the United States, President Obama and his administration knows that he lives or dies based on the American people. The American people are not happy with President Obama. He faces getting removed from office. In Africa, there have only been two instances where an incumbent government has lost an election, has been booted out of office. And both scenarios, one in Sierra Leone and the other one, I believe, was Senegal, were very unique circumstances. By and large, African governments, if you're in, you're in. You're not going anywhere. And my former professor, Paul Collier, who I was with about 3 days ago, has written extensively on these issues. Very interesting. But anyway, the point just being that things like doing business in Africa is an absolute nightmare. It does. You actually can tell that these are not governments who really want to see private sector development and people get jobs. And I'll give you some examples. Some of you might be familiar with something called the Doing Business Around the World survey, which the World Bank puts out, an excellent survey that comes out every year. Consistently, African countries rank at the bottom. As I said, it's an absolute nightmare to do business. There are some countries where it can take up to 2 years to get a business license. And it's a hassle. Numerous processes, lots of laden with bureaucracy. You know, even somebody who would be considered relatively feisty like myself has been in there in the bowels of African governments and just thought, my goodness, what an absolute nightmare. So another example is I was in Rwanda, Kenya, and Tanzania in February. Three countries relatively close to each other. And I went from, as I said, Rwanda, Kenya, and to Tanzania. Even as an African citizen, I needed three visas, and I needed to change my currency three times. To me, it was a big hassle, and I just did not understand why three countries, which are right near each other, desperately poor, need to encourage investment to come in, and also their own people to invest in the economy, they make it such a hassle to get business going. Rwanda, like Zambia, is basically landlocked 10 million people and really should be thinking about how to integrate and really start to look about in ways that regional integration, such as we've seen here in the United States or we've seen in Europe, might be the way to actually get something going. Zambia, as I said, 10 million people, landlocked, who cares? But Southern Africa, in totality, is 200 million people. All of a sudden, even business people can see a compelling case. But you know, as fractionalized independent units, this doesn't really make sense. Very quickly, let me go through the last two points. One is that aid actually contributes to the political instability that we see across the African continent. And this is really because, again, there's not much of a private sector. So really, if you're thinking about money and trying to attain higher living standards, you basically have to be in government. The money pools at the top, and that's where the money is. There's a significant and growing literature about the links between aid and civil war and civil unrest. And perhaps it will come as no surprise to people in this room that in the 1990s, Africa had more civil unrest than the rest of the world put together. And in just the last 6 to 8 months, there have been 4 coups in Africa: Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Mauritania, and Madagascar. My view, and this is, of course, this is before we add in failed states like Somalia, the dysfunctionality going in Zimbabwe, and so on. My view is that as long as money is pulled at the state and it's not being distributed through export-led growth or through development programs of job creation, we'll continue to see this cycle of despair. I had dinner with a Somalian friend of mine not too long ago who, it was actually the night that the young African pirate from Somalia had been arrested here. And of course, for her, it was very personal. And she was telling me that she left Somalia in 1992, 17 years ago, and any child, anybody who was born in 1992 or later in Somalia has not spent a single day in school. So we've lost a whole generation of young people from that country. And then we're surprised why a 17-year-old would be smiling, which he was when he was arrested, coming here as a pirate. He has no opportunities. It's also worth me pointing out here that over 60% of the African population is under the age of 24. People who've been to Africa, by show of hands, the number of people who've been to African cities recently, it's full of young people on the streets. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. And they're hawking everything, T-shirts, DVDs, stuff from China. That is not a formula for success. What's going to happen in 10 years? And for me, I find it shocking that our governments aren't stressed out when they stop at the traffic lights, even in Lusaka, and they see so many young people on the streets. They're having babies. Their babies will be on the streets as well, not too long. This is a formula for political disaster. We should be concerned. The last point is about the fact that aid disenfranchises Africans. Ultimately, I don't think it's particularly interesting that I'm standing here. And I think it's quite telling that Christina Roma is going to be speaking here in the next few weeks, because that's who we want to hear from. We want to hear from the leadership. We want to hear from the people charged with the responsibility of leading these countries. Much more interesting to have a president from Africa here explaining what their strategy is for growth and development. But the problem fundamentally is that, by and large, Africans don't really have an international voice. As I said, the ostensible face of Africa has become the celebrities and so on. But also, it's what I would call the reverse Boston Tea Party, which is no taxation without representation is the Boston Tea Party. The problem in Africa is we get no representation without taxation. African governments don't care, by and large, about what African people want, because they don't need to care. They live or die based on aid money. They care about what the donors think, by and large, but we're in this low-level equilibrium where even the donors are happy to write checks to African governments when they know that, and in the worst-case scenario, the African governments are just blatantly stealing it, and even in the best-case scenario, African governments are doing nothing to provide the public goods that we all need: HIV drugs, malaria, education, infrastructure. So, can we really count on the American government or the Western governments to really take the lead on transforming and overhauling this? I wish we could, but we can't really. Why? Because Western governments are incentivized to give money to Africa. It's the rational thing for them to do. I say this because if tomorrow President Obama stood up and said, that Dambisa Moyo's got some good points, I think we need to even start talking about just an exit strategy. Not saying he's going to turn off the taps. Let's just discuss an exit strategy for Africa to really get the African governments to do the right thing or start thinking about ways of financing development aside from aid. There would be an uproar here. The liberal consensus would stand up and say this is unfair, it's unacceptable, and so on, and it would definitely be reflected in voting patterns. But beyond that, if cancelling aid basically means that they would have to do, as Western policymakers would have to do the hard thing, which is basically open trade markets, that's something that as much as we don't like it, so for example, I think most economists and most people understand what the benefits of trade are. Look at what happened in China. 300 million people moved out of poverty. And yet, if we say trade is a good thing, we want to encourage trade across Africa, that's great. But if it might be at the expense of Americans and American jobs, well, we don't want that. So Western governments have said we can't open our trade markets because Africans can produce the same banana at a fraction of the cost. But if flooding the American market with African bananas means that American farmers will be out of work. So we'll keep the African farmers out. Same in Europe, the common agriculture policy. So African jobs get decimated, but as a way of assuaging guilt or sympathy, we'll give them aid instead, which is basically where we are now. I very much view myself as a pragmatist, so I don't feel bad about this because, yes, I think that we would love to live in an ideal world, but I don't think it's really feasible. So my recommendations, which we'll come to in a second, basically try to say what can we really do practically, what can we do to move this thing along. I just want to also say that aside from Western donors, we don't really think that they can do anything to change the system, really. We also have a situation where African governments are incentivized to take the money. It's hard work to do what I'm about to prescribe. In terms of alternative ways of financing development. And frankly, it's easier to take aid money. Who wants to go around and meet thousands of investors who are going to say, aren't you the country where there were a few bombs or aren't you the country where there's HIV/AIDS and you have to try and explain why they should be investing in your country? It's hard work. Much easier to sit around, clip coupons with money coming in from the World Bank or the IMF or whoever, and at the same time, you don't have to do anything about it. Nobody's going to be able to hold you accountable for not providing education or healthcare for your kids. So forget about their African governments. A number of them have, I must say, taken the initiative and said it's just gone too far. So we've got obviously examples like South Africa and Botswana. Ghana and Gabon have issued debt in the markets. But also even Rwanda, which I visited, and I would encourage you if you haven't been, go to Rwanda. It is an amazing, amazing story. Not so much just because they came out of a genocide, but even in isolation, what they're doing there is incredible. Just and hopefully during Q&A, I can tell you a little bit of some of the things that the government has done to reduce the expenditures in the government, the excesses of corruption and so on. And I'd love to share those with you, but I was just sensitive about time. Who else can overhaul the system? It can't be the Western donors, not likely to be the African leadership. What about the Africans themselves? I'm not here standing or pretending to be speaking on behalf of a billion Africans. I'm here in my own individual capacity. But I will say that there are many Africans who share my view that it's gone too far, particularly given the fact that we know what creates growth. As I said, places like China, 300 million people in our lifetime are out of poverty. Places like South Africa, which are really next door to my own country, have been meaningfully able to reduce poverty and unemployment from 40% to 25% without relying on aid to the same extent that the rest of the continent does. So who does that leave? It leaves Western citizens. And people ask me often, why do I think my book has actually done so well? And I think it's because we are part of a global community that is questioning everything. We're questioning capitalism, we're questioning geopolitics, and I just think it's right and prudent that we also question the aid system. There is nothing racist or evil about questioning a system that has not delivered on its promises. Things today are worse in Africa than they were 40 years ago. And to use Paul Collier's terms, Africa is shearing off from the rest of the world. So the rest of the world's going in one direction, meaningfully putting a dent in poverty, meaningfully creating jobs, meaningfully developing, and meanwhile Africa is stagnating at a very rapid rate. There is nothing wrong. we should not ascribe labels just because somebody is questioning this. Okay, I have a couple of minutes left, so I'm just going to race through the solutions. The second half of the book is all about the good news that all is not lost. We can do it. We can get back on track. The good news particularly is that this is not creating a wheel. We've seen it been done again. I'm going to paraphrase President Obama's inaugural speech where he said, basically, yes, things have been tough. The past 18 months have been horrendous for the free market model, but let's not forget that it is still the best model for creating wealth and providing freedom. It needs work. It needs to be regulated clearly. Clearly, unshackled, unfettered capitalism is not the way to go, but let's not throw out everything that we've learned over the past 100-plus years about what it is that creates growth and what doesn't. So my recommendations are things like trade with Africa. My recommendation there specifically is African governments should not spend another minute wasting their time going to the WTO. We don't have resources. Don't waste your time going to the WTO. It's not really likely that the regime is going to change. In fact, as we know, President Obama and his administration are talking more about protectionism than rather opening markets more. However, the good news is that there's China. 1.3 billion people, 7% arable land, desperately need food security. Africa's got land. We need to build alliances. But again, we need to remember, we need to incentivize the African governments to be doing the right thing, doing the things on behalf of Africans. Labor laws, environmental laws, those are all very big concerns, and we should be worried about those things. But we should not tell the Chinese to leave Africa, because they have done some amazing things across the African continent. The Pew Institute, which is an American organization, did an amazing survey, went to African countries, about 15 of them, and asked Africans, this is in my book as well, what do you think about the Chinese in Africa? How do they rank compared to the Americans in terms of improving your livelihoods? Are they better or worse? Is your living conditions better or worse? Consistently and by wide margins, Africans said, we like the Chinese. They're doing better than the Americans. They're giving us job opportunities. It's not to say that it's perfect. And a Sudanese friend of mine, who I've spent countless hours with, is asking, what do you think? I mean, I fortunately come from a country that's relatively politically stable. He's come from a place where ostensibly is being run by a tyrannical regime. And I said, how do you feel about this? The Chinese are investing in your country, but at the same time, a lot of Westerners will criticize and say that you've got a despotic regime. And he said, Tambisa, the despotic regime is a constant. Whether I'm rich or poor, I'm going to still live under a despotic regime, because my view is I'd rather have the Chinese in Sudan and I have a job and I can put food on the table for my children, rather than have an aid regime which is still financing the same despotic ruler and I can't even put food on the table. It's a cynical way of thinking, but it's a very practical when the rubber meets the road. The other things I'm going to leave for discussion, the things like the capital markets, which I've gotten slagged off by numerous people about this. There are 16 countries in Africa now that have credit ratings. I think that there is opportunity there for African governments to start thinking about that. When the market comes back, will they be ready? Will they be ready to look at alternative ways of financing? These are more transparent ways of financing, ways in which if you don't behave in the right way, the market will shut down on you. I think we should talk about that. Remittances, savings, taxes, a whole host of things. But again, hope some of these things will be teased out in the Q&A. I'm going to leave you with a rather cynical comment here that a friend of mine from Nigeria made. He was discouraging me from writing this book, saying it was kind of a waste of time. He says, nobody's going to care. And he basically said, have you asked yourself why it is that people continue to push an aid model? Given all the evidence, that's not my evidence, but evidence in the academic literature, in the policy debate literature. And he said the reason why people in the West continue to push aid to Africa is that they've lost faith in the African continent. And he specifically said, Africa is to development what Mars is to NASA. He said, every year we spend millions of dollars doing research and analysis and sending tools to investigate what's going on. But really, nobody really thinks we're ever going to live on Mars. And the problem is that nobody ever really believes that Africa is going to develop. I'm going to leave it there, and we can take questions now, I think. Is that right?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Yeah, great. Our thanks to Tambisa Moyo for her comments today. And as you can see spread out across the table here, I have a large number of questions, so why don't we begin? I'm going to start by paraphrasing a few questions that have come from people. The gist of your argument is that aid has had a series of consequences that have been negative for African societies and governments, and certainly has not incentivized governments to provide the kinds of public goods that are so necessary for societies to function. But what would these governments do, or how would these societies survive without the aid that has been propping them up, and what's the way forward? How do you go from where we are now to where you think we should be?
Thank you very much. That's a very good question. And I think the transition, I do talk a little bit about the transition in the book, but I think the transition is critical. And the way I think, thinking about where we are today, we're heavily aid-dependent, completely reliant on foreign taxpayers, to a society where Africa can be on equal playing field in terms of being part of the emerging, rapidly emerging world, or even equal to developed countries, that transition is going to be painful, for sure. But what I can guarantee ultimately is that there will be a better chance of reducing poverty and a better chance of long-term sustainable economic growth if we do pursue this much more aggressive strategy. Specifically, the manner in which I think we should approach this is by actually coming up with a finite or a policy which is a finite term for African governments to remain on aid. What do I mean by that? We need an exit strategy. Of course, it will not be one blanket policy for everyone. So we can't say, although I gave in the book, and this is one of the things that people have misquoted me on, in the book I gave a 5-year window to exit aid dependency. And by the way, I do talk a little bit about there would still be some aid, but it would be at a much reduced level. The question is, how are we going to incentivize government to do the right thing? And my view is that if tomorrow we came up with a policy where we said, you, Zambia, you claim that you need aid. We know that you need to develop your private sector. We are going to turn off the taps on some date, let's say 2050, for example. And on that day, we will meaningfully start to slash aid, whether it's by a quarter, a year, or even 50% over 2 years. But that I believe that will, if it's credible, it's real, and it's serious, will actually get African governments, Zambian government in particular, or whoever, motivated to start to figure out ways of actually replacing the aid money with some combination of what I've described to you today. The reality is, there are some countries that have already embarked on this strategy, Rwanda being one of them. They're really actively trying to get off of aid and bring in private sector, create jobs, and build up the tax base. Of course it will take time. Of course it's not 5 years for everybody, because places like Somalia, a failed state, are completely different from Zambia, which is completely different from Ghana, which is much more developed than Zambia. But I don't want to miss the fundamental point that I believe that if we do have a clear exit strategy, we can even talk about quadrupling aid in the interim for these countries, but it has to be a credible exit strategy. Governments have to do the right thing. They need to get rid of the tariff barriers between countries. In Africa, some countries to trade between the two is 30% tariffs. It's completely ridiculous. The regional integration is completely weak. I've described to you already opening a business is a nightmare. Getting visas to go to 3 countries right near each other. It's layered with these type of things that actually are so easy to transform with just one person standing up or a group of presidents standing up saying, as of tomorrow, if you're from the Southern African region, you don't need, it's a common passport or it's a common currency. These things, they even as just a signal that governments are serious, would go a long way. So we need to get the governments incentivized. I believe the way you do that is you put in a credible policy that the aid money is going to run out. And I think in some strange way, I would have hoped that the financial crisis would have done that.
You mentioned there were several questions on regional integration, and you just mentioned the importance of regional integration in the context of sub-Saharan Africa. Could you answer, how does one begin, other than stopping aid, how would one really incentivize governments that could have made steps towards regional integration already to do that when they haven't? I mean, they obviously, the benefits of it are in front of them now.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that it's not a lot of what I've said, and if there's one criticism that I think is fair, is that my book was not trying to come up with a new theory of development because we have enough evidence of what works. It was really a book that was I was trying to get the broader audience, more people involved in the debate because I felt that the fact that it was sitting up here with the intellectuals, they weren't doing enough to move the agenda forward. So with respect to regional integration specifically, we actually do have regional organizations in Africa. I mean, in fact, I think Zambia might be a member of at least eight of them. So Southern African Development Community, COMESA, ECA. I mean, we've got tons of them we've signed up to. The problem is that most of them are toothless. You know, what is the point of being part of a common agriculture policy region when actually the tariffs are still 20%? What is the point of being part of SADC, which is the Southern African Development Community, when we each still have our own passports and each have our own currencies? It doesn't make sense. This is the next level, and you're right to ask what is it going to take. My view is that it is the aid regime because I do think it's too comfortable as an African government. You know, it's bloody hot to have to go out there and start hassling to figure out what to talk about trade and all this kind of stuff. But I mean, even if two or three countries would come together and say, you know, we're going to do this, it will guilt trip the others and say this is pathetic. But the problem right now, we live in a world where the worst type of leadership, and by that I mean even the bad performers, the ones who are doing nothing, they still get a hug and a smile on the front page of the New York Times or whatever it may be. And they're not being penalized. They're not being forced to ask the hard questions. We've just come out of the biggest bull run in commodity prices in our lifetimes in the past 10 years. Where's all that money gone? Nobody's asking the question. And yet we have the celebrities outside G20 say, don't forget the Africans, you give them more money. Why are they giving us more money? We've just come out of a massive bull run. What has happened to the money? Why is nobody asking this question? These are the questions we need to ask. And unfortunately, I believe that the only way you get to that point is by a bit of tough love and turning off the tap.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Dambisa Moyo about the issues surrounding aid to Africa. I'm Smita Sings. So moving on to the next set of questions. Sitting at the center of your argument are really issues about how aid attenuates accountability between governments and their own citizens in the long run. We clearly need to create, you're suggesting, an empowered middle class in Africa that will demand the kinds of better services and better governance from their own leaders. How specifically do you think we can help create this type of an empowered middle class, especially when governments themselves have little incentives to wean themselves of aid?
Yeah. Very, very key question. I think here what I've talked about in the book is that it's virtually impossible to delink the political system that we have in Africa from the aid culture. Put a different way, we have the exact leadership that we've paid for. So things like political institutions, democracy, governance, transparency, all the good buzzwords that we desperately need and we know contribute to better living standards and conditions and societies, we will never, ever, ever get those things until it is organically grown. You cannot shoehorn them in, I'm afraid. Of course, examples like Iraq and Afghanistan have reminded us of this, but it's also no surprise that, by and large, we're seeing many more African democracies becoming a patchwork of sort of band-aid democracies to keep things together. Kenya, for example, Zimbabwe. I think it's actually a great tragedy that the West international community basically really pushed Morgan Tsvangirai to be prime minister in Zimbabwe. He's in there now. He's institutionalized. There's nothing he can do. He's not moving the needle. Mugabe is still president. I believe we're going to see a lot more of these type of patchwork kind of democratic processes because ultimately, as you say, Smith, and as I discuss in the book, we need to grow the economies. Only when they have a critical middle class, a symbiotic relationship where the Africans on the ground are basically demanding that African governments behave properly, and the governments themselves need to cater to the African people in order to stay in office. Until we get that society, which, by the way, is a society you as Americans live in, we're just having a nice chat. Because ultimately, political institutions, the legal framework, the veracity of the legal framework and judicial process, all those things have to grow organically. You cannot bring them in by flying them in and bringing them to the countries.
In your book, you argue that there are other sources of development finance for African governments, namely going to the capital markets. Several commentators have pointed out that given the global financial crisis, that these options, if they ever were really available to African governments, are really not right now. Mm-hmm. What is your response?
I'd say two responses. First of all, people love to be negative. We're going to be out of this apocalyptic situation sometime, right? It's not going to be like this forever. And we should be asking, okay, things might be tough now, but are we going to be ready? Are African countries going to be ready when everyone, investors are back, to actually look at a different way of financing development? So that's one part. And as I said, there are at least 16 countries in Africa. I wish there were more. My own country, Zambia, doesn't have a credit rating. I wish there were more countries in Africa that at least got a rating. Just because you get a rating doesn't mean you have to go and borrow, but at least it becomes a transparent way so that investors can understand what you're about. But the second point is something that on my travels, I ran into a Chinese diplomat, and I told him that I was getting a lot of flack for this idea of raising capital market money. And he said, who's criticizing you? It must be Westerners. And I said, yes. He said, yes, because they don't have money right now. You should come to China and come to the Middle East. He says, that's where they're coming. They're coming to China. You should come to China. And if you want to issue debt into our markets, we'd be very happy to take it. And so, again, it requires a mind shift. Yes, things are hard in the West right now. It's not always going to be like that. But if in the meantime, there are other places, which I would argue in some sense may even price Africa risk better, right? Because they don't come to Africa with guilt and sympathy. They're coming there for business. So the manner in which they price African risk is completely different, and I would argue better, than the manner in which Western aid has priced Africa risk. So the point is, I believe that there's a bigger world. Let's think about going to other places and issuing debt. And the last thing I would say is I had the privilege of meeting with Mohamed Yunus, who I'm sure many of you in here know, is the founder of Grameen Bank, an amazing, amazing visionary. And he said to me that in 2008, at the height of the financial crisis, he raised $1 billion from rural Bangladeshis. I couldn't believe it. I thought I was dreaming. I was like, could you just repeat that? $1 billion, rural Bangladeshis. So the capital's out there, and I was with Hernando de Soto, the Peruvian economist. It's very much his thesis. We're so focused on giving money to these countries rather than actually helping these countries to form the institutions around, and by that I don't mean giving them more aid, by creating incentives for the governments to do the right thing so that we can unlock what he would call dead capital. The money's there, but how do we make this capital alive? How do we get Africans, Zambians and myself, excited about investing in my country? I'd be excited if I knew that the government was on side. I knew the government wasn't going to steal the money. And so how do we get that? And so I think we need to change our fundamental mindset about what the problem is in Africa and how to address it.
So we're sitting in Silicon Valley, and the next question is about, do you see a potential impact for the provision of support for early-stage entrepreneurs in Africa, and what is needed beyond microfinance? And then finally, is there a role for Silicon Valley in this?
Well, first of all, I'll answer the second question first. Absolutely. The African problem is not an African problem. It is a global problem. We're all in it together. And so we should all be putting our heads together. And it's fantastic because some of the most harebrained schemes, I mean, of course, I'm not from the young, vibrant generation of Facebook and Twitter, so I never understand all these technological things. But some of the most interesting innovations are coming from people who just say, okay, I'm not going to be constrained by the status quo. I'm going to think, proverbially out of the box. And I think Silicon Valley is a hub of that. There are a lot of very interesting innovations that are going on right now. I mean, some of them like Kiva, I've talked about Kiva.org, which is a platform for lending small amounts of money. There are a number, coming to the first question, a number of social venture capital funds that are starting because there is a lot of discussion about the fact that perhaps at the very, very poor levels of economic people at very low incomes, there's a lot of attention there, and there's attention at people who are doing the big multi-billion dollar deals in Africa, but the small and medium enterprises are kind of falling by the wayside, and I think we're seeing a lot of social capital venture funds and more entrepreneurs, particularly from this area, looking at that. Things like Nick Negroponte, although he's based at MIT, his One Laptop Per Child. Some of the discussions that I've heard from some of the Facebook people about development and approaches to capital utilization, making dead capital alive, are the things that I think are incredibly interesting and the way forward.
In the beginning of your talk, you distinguished between different forms of aid and said right off the bat you weren't really going to talk about what you call charitable aid or what NGOs do. But in your opinion, have there been certain NGOs that have actually been effective in Africa, things like Room to Read, where you talked last night, or others? And what can governments and aid programs learn or adopt from these potentially effective NGOs?
Yeah. I love Room to Read, by the way. If you haven't, I should have done a massive plug for this organization that I support here in San Francisco, another incredible, incredible organization. And if the Commonwealth Club hasn't already had its founder, John Wood, I can't imagine that you haven't had him here already. But if you haven't, you absolutely should have him come here. I won't bore you with the details, but basically, from the brain of one guy working at Microsoft, I think his book is called Leaving Microsoft to Save the World. To change the world. Didn't sound right. But he left his job at Microsoft, went into the emerging world, and he's basically, we've got this strategy of trying to bring education, scholarship, and help supporting children, young children around the world, in Nepal, and now in Zambia, South Africa, and a number of other places. Anyway, that's by the by. With respect to have there been effective NGOs, the whole NGO thing, by the way, it's the sequel to Dead Aid. I'll be writing the next book, hopefully, on this matter. I'm just joking. But the point being that, listen, there are a lot of inefficiencies with the NGO system, and I'm not here to be negative and talk about those inefficiencies. Of course, things like overheads and so on have been very well documented. But, you know, if you ask me, have NGOs and the aid system been successful at what the original intention of aid was, which the two things, increase growth, reduce poverty, I would say by and large the answer is no, because look at the statistics. If you ask me, have NGOs created a well or got a girl to go to school or provided a mosquito net or, you know, given AIDS drugs to somebody, of course, how can I sit here and quibble about those type of things? Of course, they've done those things. What I'm saying to you here is that we can do it better. We can do it in a much more broad-based attack, as opposed to saving maybe 10,000 people. We can save a whole continent if we just change our mindset and change the way we approach this issue. So, you know, I don't really want to dwell on sort of the negative and how they haven't been efficient and so on, but I just think, unfortunately, we're kind of thinking too small if we just think, you know, small NGOs are the way forward. We're talking about overhauling a whole system and really transforming a continent into something that it's not today.
So a question, again, about different forms of aid. What do you think about aid in the form of scholarships for promising students in Africa?
Yeah, I love that idea. And I'm talking to a number of universities around the world now that are looking at providing scholarships. I don't really view scholarships as aid because, in a sense, you have to do something in return. You have to work hard, pass your exams, and get a degree. So it's not like it's kind of free money. I mean, I'll give you another example. I do love scholarships. I mean, obviously, I support it. Why else would I be at Room to Read or supporting education in that way? And I do think education is the real way forward. But as I said, it's for one individual. It's not going to transform a whole continent or have a continent grow at 10%. I'm really targeting how do we get a whole continent to grow at requisite levels of growth. And by the way, just so you have in your mind, the UN number that they think African countries need to grow by to put a dent in poverty is 7% a year. And so many African countries, even in the boom time, were growing at like 6%, 5%. So we were on the right track, but we need to break the 7% number. But anyway, all of this is to say that I think that there are ways to get involved. We just don't have to always think about aid as being the platform to do it.
A complex question here, and I'm going to cut it down. Is aid actually more corrupt or less successful, has it actually been less corrupt or less successful than private sector investments in sub-Saharan Africa, which have often been concentrated in the extractive industries or other commodity sectors, in actually achieving poverty reduction or positive social outcomes for a broader set of people beyond the elite who may benefit from those investments?
Okay. It's a hard question. I think the best way for me to answer that is by saying aid is not the only source of poverty or demise. The reason why my book is called Dead Aid as opposed to Dead Private Sector or something else is because aid is a very active policy. We sit in air-conditioned offices. We have rallies. We push aid. We need more aid. Triple it, double it. Things like oil endowment. So think of a place like Nigeria, which has relatively small, little aid, but has got many of the manifestations that we've just talked about. The fact we've got high corruption, large bureaucracies, relatively bad growth numbers in private sector. Those are things that are also an artifact of a country which suffers from what they call the oil curse. So aid is not the only source of this problem, but I've picked aid because I believe that the fact that we are actually actively pushing a policy that is detrimental is the issue we should deal with. With respect to the extractive industry, there are some very interesting initiatives going on right now, which I hope will have teeth. I hate sitting around tables and having chat, and not much action. And in fact, if anything, I would say what the development industry has shown us is that we get an A-plus for theory and an F for implementation, because all these things about trade and private sector development and all this is all from the Washington consensus of the 80s and 90s, and Smita will agree, but the fact of the matter is we haven't implemented, and I've got lots of examples of this. But what I will say, over 85% of stocks that trade in Africa today are not commodity-related. So as much as we focus on the natural resource story, again, focusing on the negative, we forget over 85% are non-commodities. They're banks, telecommunication companies, retail sector, food and clothing. So let's focus on those positive stories, and then I think we'll have much broad-based growth than we're seeing by just focusing on the extractive industries. Of course, extractive industries are problematic. But the things like the EITI, Extractive Industry, Transparency International, Peter Eigen's baby, making strides towards actually really focusing on overhauling the systems.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question. And that question is, what was it or what was the moment at which the light bulb went off for you that made you realize that donor aid was so toxic?
Yeah. You know what? I wish I could say there was one moment, because it sounds so much more sexy. But the fact of the matter is, I think if you're growing up in Africa or in many places around the world, probably places like Haiti as well, or even places like Bangladesh, I think it becomes so normal to accept inefficiency, corruption, poor performance by governments, and so on. And for me, I consider myself incredibly fortunate, and I'm very, very grateful for the fact that I've been able to spend time outside of my continent, in fact, even within my continent, but outside my country, and really see that other countries, other regions of the world do things differently. There is a different way. There is another way of approaching these issues that has been incredibly successful. And I have a lot of faith in my country. I have a lot of faith in my continent. And I know it's about implementation. And I know that if we can actually get the message across that there is a better way for Africa, we can actually put a dent in this problem.
Thank you. Thanks to Dambisa Moyo, the author of Dead Aid, Why Is Aid Not Working and How Is There a Better Way? And Is There a Better Way for Africa? We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program has been generously underwritten by the Caret Foundation. I'm Smita Singh, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you very much.